don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
I'm going to have to start today's episode with an apology. Because as soon as you hear the identity of our guest, you're going to be jumping down my throat asking, what took you so long? Welcome to the show, hey Murph.
Hey, Ud, how's it going?
Ardal O'Hanlon is an Olivier and BAFTA-nominated actor who was hugely influential in establishing a thriving comedy scene in Dublin. He's written two critically acclaimed novels, as well as making documentaries on art, natural history and religion. Is there anything I'm forgetting? Oh, yeah. He also starred in the greatest Irish television show of all time, Father Ted, which is fast approaching its 30th anniversary. Not to mention his role in another programme that's high on that all-time list, Derry Girls. And the man is, to put it mildly, sports mad, all of which I think makes him the perfect person to take a crack at being our greatest non-sports person, sports person. I, for one, Murph, I'm excited to see how he goes today.
Yeah, you've kind of nailed it there. This is a guest tailor-made for this show. Like, he's done documentaries on soccer's greatest rivalries. He's a huge Ireland football fan. And we're also in a position to confirm today that he did all of his own football stunts in Father Ted as well. That was not a hired body double having a kick around with Father Damo all those years ago. Every kick of the ball seen in that series was done by the man himself, which shows you how seriously he approaches both his acting and his football.
Now that's the kind of stuff I want to hear about. If this is the sort of information that may help him to wrestle top spot from the vice-like grip of Brendan Gleeson, who continues to lead the way with just 2 weeks to go.
Could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Yeah, well, I'm not prepared to call it just yet, as there are still two high-quality guests left, but Brendan's score of 83 points is, historically speaking, eminently get-attable. We've had winning scores of 88 from the likes of Malcolm Gladwell and Gabby Logan in the past, multiple guests per series breaking that magical 85-point mark. I'm not saying that it's going to happen today, but you'd have to think that 83 is looking precarious. As for Ardal, he is no doubt by now acutely aware that I will rank his sporting ability, choose a sports person that I feel most closely resembles him, and then assess his all-time sporting highlight before giving him a score out of 100 to see if he can take top spot. It promises to be a breathlessly exciting denouement to today's show. I promise you, algorithmic fireworks.
Not a phrase I've ever heard, Murph. It's a new one on me. Email editor at secondcaptains.com. Tweet at secondcaptains. Ardal O'Hanlon is in studio after we hear a little bit of Oasis for the week that's in it.
I would like to leave this city, this old town, don't smell, don't feel dead. Don't feel dead. Don't feel dead.
Half the World Away by Oasis on Second Captain Saturday. Today's guest is someone we've been trying to get on the show for years now. We first asked him on back in 2017, so this conversation has been a long time in the making, and today we finally have our man, Ardal O'Hanlon. Welcome to studio.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I know why it's taken so long. You've been waiting for a winnable series, and you've seen Brendan Gleeson's 83 points and thought, that's
Yes. I'll have some of that.
Yeah, I've been in training.
We can get some early points on the board for you here, Ardal, by connecting you to one of the most joyous days in Irish football history, the day that Jason McAteer scored a goal at Lansdowne Road against Holland.
That's
and
right.
And you were there, but you were double jobbing that day.
I was, yeah. That day, you two were playing at Slane Castle. Mm-hmm. And Moby was kind of the second headliner, I think, that day. And Moby asked me, I didn't know Moby, but he asked me to sing a song with him on stage. And that song was My Lovely Horse from the hit comedy show Father Ted.
We remember, yeah.
And to be honest with you, my first reaction was to say no, because I was going to the Ireland match. So then I get a call from Moby's people, and he said, well, look, we'll have a helicopter on standby after the match in Lansdowne Road, and we'll fly you down to Slane. So I went, okay, I've run out of excuses here. And so jumped in the helicopter, myself and my wife. He brought me up on stage. We rehearsed briefly in the helicopter.
So you were with Moby on this helicopter?
Yeah.
Oh, so did, wow. Yeah. Did Moby go to the game or did he?
No, he didn't go to the game. Right, No. I was just whisked, I think is
the
word.
To a
waiting helicopter. It was like the last days of Saigon or something, you know.
Yeah. Or so, a Celtic Tiger wedding.
Exactly. So we just rehearsed very briefly. He knew the words better than I did, let me tell you. And there is a sort of... There's a preamble to this story. A couple of years previously, I was at a comedy festival in New York, and there was a Q&A session about Father Ted at this, and it was very sparsely attended. There was only about 40 or 50 people there, but one of them was Moby. And he was sitting there on his own, and he was just asking nerdy questions about Father Ted.
This is Moby in what, like 97? This is huge Moby.
Oh, yeah.
Play was the huge album. Millions. Yeah. 12 million copies, I think.
Wow.
That's right, yeah. And so he was one of the biggest artists in the world at the time. And then getting up on stage, like, that was just, it was kind of terrifying in a way. Like, you know, I'd be used to reasonably big crowds. You know, you play to, well, anything from 10 people in a pub to, like, a couple of thousand people in a nice theatre. But nothing like this. I wasn't prepared for it. You know, 80,000 people talk about the energy. It was phenomenal. It was like a tsunami of energy, and it hit you. It kind of flattens you. It knocks the wind out of you. And it made me go momentarily blind. So I was up there. I don't even remember it. Like, I literally don't remember it. It wasn't until many years later, decades later, I happened to know one of the guys who was filming the backstage stuff for U2. But eventually I saw it. It was phenomenal.
What a day that was.
Yeah, it was a great day. Yeah. I mean, most of my best days, I have to be honest with you, do revolve around like sporting occasions of some sort or another.
You've always been big into it, like, as a kid?
Always loved it. Football mainly. I mean, you know, I played Gaelic football up to under 16 level, but soccer was my sport. Like, I was absolutely fanatical about it, like a lot of kids.
Mm. What would a football match have looked like between you and your mates? Where would you have been playing there?
So I lived in this little street called Mullinary in Carrickmacross, and right next door is a pig farm. So there was the gates of the pig farm was one goals, and then there was a warehouse across the road, which was kind of like, I think it stored grain, but it stored different things over the years. But it was a grain store, I remember, when I was a kid, and there were huge doors there, like huge big sliding doors, like about 20 foot high and 20 foot wide. So, you know, it was uneven. It was unbalanced. But, like, yeah, there'd be about 20 kids. Like, there was a lot of kids in our street, the Donnellys next door, Smith's up the road. So, you know, you'd have about 10 aside maybe on this tiny little bit of road. Yeah, that's where I learned. That's where I learned to play on the streets.
You were a street footballer.
On the mean streets of Carrickmacross.
You've described yourself.
In your shoes, in your good shoes. Yeah, of course. You didn't have runners and shoes. You just had shoes.
You've described yourself as a really shy kid. Do you think football helped with that?
I think that's interesting. You know, I never really thought of it like that, but absolutely, like, you know, the one place where I felt really comfortable was on a football field. I'm not saying I was a great player or anything. I'm just saying that I felt really comfortable on a football field. I thought I knew what I was doing compared to the other muck savages.
The Donnellys. It is a mode of expression, though, isn't it?
It absolutely is. It's very creative. It is social in a way, even though you don't necessarily have to talk to anyone. You know, there's a lot of grunting goes on and pointing, but, you know, that's a way of communication. Absolutely. It just, you know, and people, you know, you were seen. It was a way to be seen as well. Like, you know, for someone who was a shy person, third child, big family, you know, I suppose, yeah, it was a way you could show off.
Big family and a busy house by the sounds of it. Like, your father was a GP and a TD. There's a combination. There were a lot of people through the doors in your house. It probably wasn't always easy to be seen.
No, there was a lot of coming and going. But at the same time, like, that was kind of, you know, it was kind of exciting, I suppose. There was always drama. There was always, like, life about the place, I suppose. You'd end up, like, sitting in the hall. So my father had his surgery, like, at one side of the house, and then he had his political clinic at the other side of the house. And he'd be running from one to the other, you know, with his stethoscope hanging off him. And then he'd be running in to deal with some planning permission issue or something on the other side. And then we'd be caught in the middle. And you'd end up just I suppose, having the crack, for want of a better word, with these constituents or patients or whatever. So, like, because there was literally hundreds of people sometimes in the house during the course of a day. So you'd end up being exposed to a lot of guff and crack and, you know, and of course, Monaghan's all very deadpan and, you know, you don't really know where people are coming from, if people are serious or not. And, you know, so you kind of, you pick up a lot of stuff that you only realise, you know, much later on that, oh, I've used that, you know, I've kind of trailed on that myself.
It's funny you say that obviously you realise certain things about your childhood later on, not while it's actually happening. But would you have been aware at that stage that your family occupied a certain place in the community based on what we're talking about there?
You just reminded me there of something. A friend of mine told me that he was given a eulogy at his brother's funeral, and he said this brilliant quote, which I always remember. He said, he was talking about his brother, his childhood got more unhappy as he got older. Like, his point being that they had a very happy childhood, but as he got older, he started reflecting on his childhood in a different way. Like, my parents were incredibly humble people, despite the fact that he pushed himself out there and, you know, like, went into politics, you know, which, like, obviously no sane, rational person should ever contemplate. So, you know, but they were very modest people, very humble people. But, like, there was this kind of thing, like, he did have a lot of respect. You know, I remember one time, like, some boys were picking on me or something, and someone said, no, that's the doctor's son, you can't do that. Wow. But it wasn't that he was the doctor's son, it was that he had probably done a turn for that person's parent or something, you know what I mean? So there weren't enough hours in the day for him to do what he felt he should be doing, which was public service. And I know politicians get a hard time. My experience of living with a politician when I was a child was that he just couldn't do enough for people.
Sounds like you were never going to go down that political route. Were you ever tempted to go down the medical route, become a doctor yourself?
No, God, no. No, my head was in the clouds all the time throughout childhood. I was either reading books or I was playing football. That was it. Like, it was. Yeah. So I loved reading. Like, I read everything, you know. I did literally read the entire encyclopedia.
Yeah.
I was a precocious child. I always wrote, actually, from an early age, wrote little funny poems and stories. And, you know, I think I even started a novel, like, when I was 14 or something. I had a detective who was based in Montreal. Philippe somebody. I can't remember his surname. But
why Montreal? I can only imagine that your knowledge of Montreal was sketchy at 14.
Look, I don't want to give away too much. Yeah. I really was a dreamy kid. Like, I used to carry an atlas around with me, and I had I can't believe I'm telling you this.
Please do.
I had imaginary pen pals, like, in places like Seoul in South Korea, and probably one in Montreal as well. I lived in my head. Mm. Absolutely.
When was the seed planted then for a shy kid to go into something that would be most shy children's worst nightmare, I would say?
I mean, for me, it was debating at school, first of all, and then at college, like, just putting myself forward, possibly in a way, like, echoing the way my father, who was a very shy man, put himself forward for politics. Like, you know, and it's interesting, like, as you know, I've spent decades doing comedy now, and you meet all sorts of people, and an awful lot of them would be coming from a similar area. Like, it's you know, they're not necessarily the most outgoing people in the world. As it happens, I am a very outgoing person now, and I maybe stand-up helped me overcome all those sort of
fears. It's a feeling that so many people are really familiar with. I mean, it's the most common fear in the world is of public speaking.
Yeah.
And so to kind of look it directly in the eye and take it on is kind of it's a mad way of dealing with.
Yeah, it is. It's an overcompensation. But I mean, it's not just public speaking. It's like the anxiety of, like, you know, I always had good friends and you know, I was always the most well-adjusted person in the room. But I had, like, you would have the anxiety of going into a pub, into a crowded space, you know. And I remember, like, even when I was in college and after college, you know, when I felt like I found myself or whatever, you know, you find your voice, I suppose, in company and so on. Like, there'd be days where you'd be going into the pub and you'd stop at the door and go, I just don't feel like it tonight, and go home again. Like, that would happen, you know. So in a way, stand-up, like, by I suppose, taking a gig, taking a booking, you know, you've committed to doing something in a way of leaping off a platform or, you know, breaking through a wall or something.
Yeah.
You know, you've made that commitment. And I think that sort of helps you overcome it. And then I know from talking to a lot of comedians that, like, people are more comfortable talking to 2,000 people in a room than two or three people in a room.
Really, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people I know would be a bit like that.
That tension you talk about, Ardal, between a natural shyness when you were young and wanting to perform, but the anxiety around performance. Did external validation help when you started becoming really successful, when you started getting awards and being in big television shows? Did that kind of thing help you?
Well, I mean, I suppose it does to some extent, but like, and I'm much better than I was. Like I was notoriously, you know, terrible before a show, you know, for hours and hours and hours. You know, I couldn't think about anything else, couldn't eat, you know.
It's a tough way to be.
Yeah, it's terrible. And that went on for years and years and years. Now, as soon as you got on stage, it was fine. But like, and that's improved enormously over the years. But you still have the self-doubt. Like, it never goes away. You still think, you know, I did an Electric Picnic there a few weeks ago. And like, you know, you just think, why am I doing this? How is this going to work? Even now, in a field, like, you know, with music spilling in from everywhere and... You just think, like, why am I doing this? This can't possibly work. And who would be remotely interested in anything I have to say? You know, so that those doubts will never go away. Yeah. But yes, you know, experience tells you that 99.999% of the time it goes well. And, you know, you've done your homework. You've prepared properly. You're experienced at this. You know what you're doing. In fact, you know, The validation thing, it is massive. You know, you do shows all the time because you're constantly being told that, oh, comedy's changing and, you know, you can't say this and you can't say that. And, you know, it's kind of changing in terms of, you know, like, you know, it's all about identity now and identity politics and so on. But like, that's overstated. You know, you go on a show and people are delighted to see you. They're delighted to see someone who is good at their craft and, you know, and of course... You know, from my point of view, you know, my comedy, my thoughts, my whatever, my approach to it, my comedy philosophy is every bit as valid as anyone else's, you know. So that's the way I look at it.
The voice you are hearing is a very familiar one. It belongs to Ardal O'Hanlon, who's in studio with us today on Second Captain Saturday. We're back after these.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.
You're listening to Ardal O'Hanlon with Owen and Murph on Second Captain Saturday. And given the bombshell news that Liam and Noel Gallagher have patched things up for a comeback tour, it would be remiss of me not to ask you, Ardal, which one do you actually prefer, Oasis or Blur? I'm sorry.
You know, I'm agnostic on that.
Are you? Yeah.
I was there. I was there for Britpop. I lived in London the early 90s. Follow the fortunes of all the runners and riders.
Did you ever meet any of them socially? I'm sure you did.
No, I didn't actually. No, I met The Fall, all right, who kind of predate Britpop.
Nothing wrong with that.
I used to listen to Oasis quite a lot, I have to admit. The Definitely Maybe album, when it came out, like, I thought was really great. And I probably kind of marginally leaned towards Blur when it boils down to it.
Yeah,
I'm more of an indie kid.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. You know, but I mean, I've listened to a lot of Oasis this week.
That answer,
you know,
would not have worked in the Father Ted scene.
No, I don't think so.
It had to be a little snappier.
No. Yeah, a little snappier. But it is true, you know, that you're kind of... It's so redolent of the time. It's incredible to listen to it and just immediately be thrown back into, in my case, secondary school and just how massive that whole thing was for kids, and probably, you know, for the even more so for lads at that time. But I mean, they're embracing kind of their heyday of the 1990s. How do you feel now about your time on Father Ted, now that it's the same period of time, it's whatever it is, nearly 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we were all part of that wave. Like, I think you know, I was on the cover of Loaded magazine, you know.
Were you? Once.
Yeah, I was. I'm not sure how proud I am of that now.
I mean, it's just a thing that happened.
And I was on the cover of other music magazines of the time as well, and, you know, film and culture magazines as well. So, you know, in fact, there was one of, like, there was a, I think it was in one of the magazines, it was the class of 96 or something, and we were there with Oasis in the photo. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I suppose we were kind of part of that to some extent.
It's a really complex dynamic, though, isn't it? Because, you know, the Gallagher brothers can't escape from the role that they have, you know, and you see them now, you know, rebooting it for what will be obviously huge gigs next year. But you also don't want to be defined by it. I mean, the galleries can't escape it in the way that maybe you could.
I wouldn't be talking about it if you weren't asking me about it.
Yeah.
But
that's true.
But look, I've always been very grateful for Father Ted, and also like I'm a very patient man. So,
what does that mean? Patient with a bite
my
time.
I met one of the guys from Inbetweeners, and he was going through the same sort of thing as I probably went through after Father Ted. Like maybe 5 years on, like he was struggling to escape from what he saw as a straitjacket because he was a very serious actor, whereas I wasn't really at the time. I was a stand-up comedian, kind of straying into acting. So for me, this was just like a different world and a kind of a bonus. You know, I never consciously traded on Father Ted. Like I always just got on with the next job. I always got on with the next gig. Like even when I was making Father Ted, I was traveling up and down the country in the UK, like doing shows here, there and everywhere. You know, there were times when it never became hard. Like there was, you know, we slipped under the radar to some extent, but I've got the opportunity to do loads of different things since, you know, loads of other acting jobs. Some of them a bit like do, but you know, I make documentaries, I wrote novels, I continue to do stand up. So it didn't stop me doing anything I wanted to do.
It was part of it. Some of the choices you've made. You said you didn't consciously trade on that role. Did you actually consciously try to move away from it?
Yeah, I would say so. In terms of the stand up, I certainly tried to. Follow my own comedy instincts, which at that time was certainly to sort of make my own stuff a bit more robust and less fluffy and more conversational and less gag based, you know. So, you know, and that's an ongoing evolution. You know, that's what you do as a comedian is you just try and reflect where you're at in your own life at any one time. Yeah. Like I will often mention Father Ted purely maybe because I'm very conscious, like I'm lucky, like I'm still getting an audience who are coming to me because of Father Ted. So, and just as sometimes as a little nod, you might just start with a little throwaway reference to Father Ted, but then you're immediately into the body of your set. And, you know, that's about like facial hair.
Has it changed over time as well, Ardal? Has it become easier over time that you can look back fondly on that time without being defined by it now?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah. No, definitely. I think, you know, the other way of going about it is to just shut down any conversation about it. And that's just churlish and, you know, unnecessary. Like, I'm very proud of Father Ted. It was I look back on it very, very fondly. It's you know, the show is still fairly fresh and it's still very fresh in my mind. You know, all those lovely times and those lovely times with those great people that I worked with. Yeah, you know, like it's absolutely no skin of my nose to talk about it or anything. You know, as long as I get to talk about other stuff as well.
Other stuff, including theatre, which you wanted to ask you about today and where that fits in. You've had huge success on stage, most recently Dancing at Lunasa, the West End last year, which is obviously one of the great Irish plays of the last 50 years. It must have been a really exciting production to be
part. Yeah, that was incredible. Like, I only do, like, I came to theatre late because I didn't have the confidence to call myself an actor for many, many years, even after Father Ted and one or two other jobs that I did after that. So it wasn't until someone approached me to do theatre. It was actually the Gate Theatre in Dublin. And that was my first foray, maybe around 2004 or something. And I got a real taste for it. I loved it. I loved the process and I loved the deep dive. Like in television, you don't really rehearse. You get a script and then you turn up and you might be doing it out of sequence and you might be meeting the other actors for the first time. And you have to just come in with a character fully formed, and that's, you know, that's a challenge, and it's a challenge that most actors embrace. But theatre is different. You've got 7 or 8 weeks of a really deep immersion into the material, into the character, and you learn so much about yourself and other people and the world and the subject matter of the play. So this one, Dancing at Lunasa, was just a godsend. Like, I always wanted to do Friel. I always wanted to work in the National Theatre in England, which is just like an incredible place, an incredible institution, which produces amazing work year in, year out. And this cast was incredible. So they got Siobhan McSweeney from Derry Girls, Louisa Harland from Derry Girls. They got Alison Oliver, who had just been seen in Normal People, who's gone on to amazing things. You Tom Vaughan Lawler, incredible actor, you know. Tom Riley, Bláthnaid McGowan, you know, all these just brilliant, brilliant actors. An amazing set. Hannah Peel did the music, who's this incredible kind of electronic, classical crossover artist. And so you have all these amazing creatives. You have this, like, just brilliant family atmosphere. And in my opinion, it was a really, really good production. I know the Friel family gave it its blessing. Anne Friel, you know, Brian's widow, loved it.
It was very kind about you as well. She singled you out, didn't she? Just as a wonderful performance.
Okay, well, I'll take that.
Yeah, no, she did. No, she.
That makes it all worthwhile. Yeah. See, that's the validation we were talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's a tricky part, you know. Like, I was playing the Father Jack role. For anyone who's familiar with the play, and there's a really good production on in the gate. It's not our production, but it's very different. And it's a really hard part to do. You know, it's a returned missionary priest, but all that kind of entails. Coming back, trying to impose his vision of how life should be lived on his sisters, who never had the opportunities to kind of escape poverty in 1930s Donegal. So, like, it's hard. And I think Brian, I think he always felt that people weren't getting it or whatever, that particular role. And it's, you know, that was a spur to make sure that you didn't, you know, you did something different and something that you thought Brian might like with this.
Yeah. Like, another big element of the play is how the family are seen externally by the community, by the church. And again, that, like, relating back to sort of your own childhood, you know, that you're kind of, okay, this is, you have to understand how the family are viewed outside the home, even though so much of the play is inside the home.
Yeah, you know, that's Ireland. That's rural Ireland, small town Ireland. You know, it's all about appearances and, you know, propriety and, you know, piety and all these things, you know. And I suppose, like, I never really had an ideology, for want of a better word, or anything like that. But even as a child, like, you're very aware of, I suppose, what we now call kind of dysfunction. You know, just the way we did things in Ireland and possibly the way we still do them, you know. And I suppose that's why I was drawn to the arts as such, is because that's, you know, my dad was drawn to politics, and that's a way of addressing problems and issues as well. You know, journalism is another way of going about it, you know, but writing and by extension performing what you write is to me a very legitimate response to just what you see around you growing up. And, you know, so even though I wasn't conscious of it at all, I think I was an observant child because I was kind of watchful and you know, I always think of, like, Village of the Damned for some reason, you know, these little watchful, blondie, blue-eyed children. I was one of them.
You went back during lockdown and tried to connect with yourself as a kid. I don't know if that's a clunky way of phrasing it, but you went back through some old home videos,
yeah,
and articles and stuff you'd written and
on. Old diaries and stuff.
Why did you do that aside from just maybe boredom or something?
Yeah, boredom, clearing out the attic, all that kind of stuff. I mean, lockdown was amazing in many ways, you know, as a period for reflection, like, and seeing where you're at and resetting. And I think it's hard not to be hard on yourself, as, you know, and all the kind of mistakes and missteps you make, you know. It's like the caution, I would say, was something that always held me back a little bit. You can't do that, you can't say that, you know.
You'd probably like to give yourself a break. I'd say a lot of us might be like that, like, just tell your 10-year-old self to
just relax. Don't be so hard on yourself. Yeah. Exactly, you know. And I think I was just very cautious when I was younger, even as a comedian, like, which is, you know, it's almost like a contradiction in terms to say something like that, because you really are taking a big chance getting on stage. But in terms of, like, you know, I suppose I was mindful of my career and, you know, I better watch out for that and not do that. Like, for example, like, you know, since COVID, I think, like, I'm enjoying, like, you know, the best period of my career, to be honest with
really,
you.
Really, yeah?
Yeah, really. I have to say that. Not in as high profile a way as earlier parts of my career, but, like, you know, things like, I did Taskmaster a few years ago, which I would never have done pre-COVID. Mm. I just wouldn't have. I wouldn't have put myself in that environment. You know, oh, that's too scary. Oh, you know, I wouldn't be very good at improvising, or, you know, not having a safety net, or, you know, not having lines to fall back on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I have to say, my wife absolutely, my wife said, you have to ask him about Taskmaster. He was amazing.
Oh, you don't have to ask me. I'll tell you about Taskmaster. It was the best fun I ever had in my life.
Really?
And
wow.
Again, so that is that's, you know, one example of how, you know, I think my career changed, but also my life changed. Like, you know, that just, it was liberating for me, all that kind of stuff. And I've done a few things like that since, various podcasts, you know, and stuff that I would have just, I won't do that. No, it's too, you know, I'm not in control, you know. Mm. Or, you know, even with the acting as well, like I've done 4 or 5 jobs this year. In previous years, you know, you might do one job and you might think, okay, that's enough. You know, I don't want to be overexposed, stuff like that. Or, you know, it's not big enough, that role, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear. What's not good to hear is that you've had to leave your football playing days behind, Gerald.
Yeah. The last football match I played was, well, so I did this show, Death in Paradise.
In the Caribbean.
In the Caribbean, in Guadeloupe, yeah. And I'd sort of, my football career was sort of over by then. So this is, we're talking about 2018 now. It was well over by then, to be honest with you. But there was the odd match between sort of Britain stroke Ireland. I was the token Irish person. Against like France stroke Guadeloupe. So, and like it was, the conditions were horrendous. Like it was very humid, very hot. And, you know, you'd be playing like in you know, naked practically. So, and I just remember like there was one night there, my son was out with me on holidays for the week, and me and my son were playing together, and it was great. And I was playing out of my skin. I just couldn't put a foot wrong. You know, just my control was there where it had to be. I was scoring for fun. Scored a great volley. This is not my sporting moment, by the way.
Wow. This sounds like a sporting moment.
And I just thought, okay, I'm back. My football career is back on track. And of course, what I didn't want to realize was that because I was the lead actor in the show, no one was allowed to tackle me. So I had all this extra time to take the ball under control and to steady myself.
That's what all the best players look like. They always look like they've got that extra second.
Yeah. So, and then I came back to Ireland and in September, and I played up in UCD 5-a-side, and I wrenched my groin in the first 5 minutes, and I was out of action for about a year. Like, I mean, you know,
was it?
Literally, no, I couldn't hack it.
Tennis has come into your life, though. I hope this doesn't sound like I'm overstating it, you wrote recently, but I'd say that tennis changed my life.
Yes, it did, sort of, yeah. Yeah, it was a game I discovered after I stopped playing football. And, you know, when a lot of my friends were choosing golf over life itself, I went for tennis. It was handier. You know, the tennis is over in an hour and a half, you're back home. You know, you can go back to work or whatever, or watch a box set. So, and it was just a game that I kind of took to. Do you know, I'd played against the wall when I was younger, but I'd never really played a proper tennis match. And I got a little bit of coaching and then I just played and played and played, and, you know, try and play 3 or 4 times a week. Even now, like I just can't wait to get out, you know.
How has it changed your life? Because that sounds pretty profound.
Well, like, I suppose when I was younger and, you know, when kids were coming along and everything, like, I didn't really do much of anything. So, like, I was maybe still playing the odd 5-a-side. Mm. But, you know, you end up sitting at home drinking wine every night. Mm. Like, and, you know, maybe working too hard as well. Do you know, away from home quite a lot on jobs and all of that. And tennis was a great settler, you know. It's also so rooted in the community, so you know all the people in the club, or you get to know them pretty soon. You know, and it's a real leveler as well. Like, there's something lovely about sports clubs generally. You know, you're sitting there, you're in your shorts. I a lot of these people, I've never seen them in their clothes. You know, I don't know what they do for a living. Like, I don't care. You know, and you just have these lovely chats, and you know, and then the game itself is so good for your mental health and your physical health as well. I play doubles, so it's not, you know, it's not a huge workout a lot of the time, but it's so good for your mental health. It's the metronomic quality of it and everything else, and it's solutions based. You know, there's a solution to everything that comes at you, and, you know, it's your job to work that out very quickly, and some days you'll do it better than others. So it's just a lovely thing. I, you know, there's just, oh, it's beautiful.
Is it true, Ardal, that you turn down professional opportunities if they clash with your tennis matches? You'll prioritize tennis.
Yeah, I've made some terrible career decisions based on that. Yeah. There was one like where I was to meet a director and it wasn't even like a league game or anything, or you know, it was just a game that I committed to and I didn't want to miss it. But that's what I mean. Like, it has changed my life so far as like you know, prioritize, not pleasure, like the self-esteem song. But prioritize life. You know, like career is very important, and I love it. And I don't even think of it as career as such as work. I mean, you know, it's something I really, really want to do. But I also really, really want to play tennis.
Yeah. And you know, listen, Daniel Craig did a great job as James Bond, so it worked. Maybe it worked out for the best for everyone.
But you get it to do. I do it with my wife. I do it with my kids. Like, you know, last night we didn't even play in our local club. We went up to Bushy Park and you know, I played with my wife and two of my kids, and we had a fantastic time.
You still haven't got to your sporting highlight, Ardal. I'm intrigued now as to what that is, because you've given us a couple of contenders already.
Oh God,
what have we got?
There's so many. No, it has to be tennis related. So about, will we see now? Oh, when was it? 5 years ago, the Brookfield Club Handicaps. Me and Brian Walsh. we were one set down to two young fellas.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah.
Real hot shots in the club.
Yeah.
Like really good players. First teamers, and we didn't have much of a handicap. Now, in fairness, we'd hardly any, maybe like a point every three games or something. And everyone had written us off. There's a big crowd there. Like, there's never a crowd watching you play tennis, but this was the final of the club handicaps, 2020, and we won. So we came back from one set down, two sets to one, and I've never been happier in my life. I got the trophy. It's slightly bashed. And then we punched the opposition as well.
Your serve held up under pressure. What was it? What was the key to victory, Ardal, do you think? How did you turn it around?
It was playing the next shot. It wasn't playing the last shot. It's playing the next shot, which is the most important thing in tennis. It's playing the next shot and steady. Younger players are always going to give you a chance because they're going to get too hot-headed. They're going to want to smash you into oblivion.
You use all your craft, your ring craft.
All your craft. Doubles is also like, it suits crafty people. And my partner is very crafty. You get lucky sometimes. Like, my drop shots were coming off. They never do. Like, I go years without a drop shot coming off, and suddenly in this game, they were all coming off.
Now, sorry, you mentioned there was a big crowd there. Were you guys the crowd favourites, or were they up for the young hotshots?
Who's shouting for young hotshots?
Yeah, exactly.
No one likes young hotshots.
They like the crafty outfits.
I'm going to show you the photo after of...
Please.
Of receiving the trophy from the club president, Liz Quinn.
The number one spot is under threat here, Murph, I have to say.
I'm reeling. I have to gather myself here.
Murph, please rank this sporting life of Ardal O'Hanlon.
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Ardal, the polite thing to do at this juncture would be to shake hands, tell each other that we've had a wonderful time, and be on our way. But that's not what this show is about. I'm brought in here right at the end to sour the mood, tell you the sports person that I feel most closely resembles you, and then give you a score out of 100 based on your all-round sporting ability and your sporting highlight to see if you've got what it takes to take down Brendan Gleeson and take top spot in the race to crown our greatest non-sports person sports person for 2024. First of all, you're a football man, of that there can be no doubt. From the mean Bahrain of Carrickmacross to the bright lights of London, England, you've brought your love of the beautiful game with you. But I'm most interested in this jaunt in the Caribbean, where you were lording it over your tackle-shy fellow cast members and crew. Their pathetic pandering to their star of the show reminds me of Kim Jong-il's first round of golf, where, according to his playing partners, he apparently registered 11 holes in one and shot 38 under on his first ever round of golf. I shudder to think of the culture of fear you promoted on that shoot. Your newfound love of tennis is both endearing and points-worthy, and your Brookfield Club handicap exploits, beautifully outlined to us there, will live on forever, as is your part in making the day of Jason McAteer's winner against the Netherlands even better than 80,000 people in Slain could have thought possible. Listen, I'm rabbiting on here. The point of the matter is that you have scored 86 points. You are our new leader. Oh. Ardal O'Hanlon, this has been your sporting
life. What about that, Ardal?
Well, this is one of the highlights of my life. This is it. Beating Brendan Gleeson.
And not just beating him either, like beating him like a drum. Yeah. You know, really kind of
Show
coming on here.
Oscars up.
Really humiliating the guy.
A round of applause, please. Yeah. It's been brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. For Ardal O'Hanlon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To be honest, I'm not sure how Moby found the time to write that song, Porcelain, seeing as he seemed to spend all of his time in the 90s watching Father Ted episodes and turning up at Q&As to pepper Ardal O'Hanlon with obscure references. We have a new series leader, and Murph, I know he had you hooked from that opening anecdote, whisked off from Lansdowne Road in Moby's helicopter to sing My Lovely Horse in front of 80,000 fans in Slain. 23 years ago, tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Well, I mean, it was September, yeah.
I was at Slain that night.
Bloody hell, I wasn't at that gig.
No.
Yeah, I was at the one either the week before or the week after.
I was before, yeah, and I was just checking the dates.
It was before,
just checking
it?
The dates here, yeah. There was that one, and then this was the second one, I do believe. I can tell you one man who wasn't there, though, was the hero of the day, Jason McAteer. I remember thinking, this would be just the greatest moment of my life if McAteer walks out here now and creates the goal. It's got to happen. You two had the same idea. Bono reported they offered to lay on a chopper for McAteer as well. Helicopters just left, right and centre leaving Lansdowne Road and heading towards Slain. But Ireland's goal scorer preferred to honour his commitment to meet up with John Aldridge for a pint in town. We've met Aldo, another legend of Irish football. You've got to say that. But I feel Jason McAteer might have missed a trick that night. I don't know.
That was a bad decision. That was just a straight up bad rog decision by Jason McAteer. But you know, I hope they had a nice couple of pints on him.
Yeah, I mean, he should have been riding that wave of euphoria all the way down to Slain. Maybe he just knew it would have been too much joy. It would have been too much for everybody at Slain that night if McAteer popped out on Slain. Congratulations to Ardal, who only has to hold on for 1 week to be crowned our greatest non-sportsperson 2024. Final show of the series, same time next Saturday. This has been a Second Captains production for RTE, produced by Killian Down. Mark Horgan is the series producer for Second Captains. Thanks to Johnny Lanigan and RTE. You can listen to us every day on secondcaptains.com. Thank you, Murph.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.